So first, let's thank me for having possibility here at Berkeley. And yeah, it's my talk with you about extension of techniques developed.
Can you put your mic on?
So as you can see, my talk will be about extension of the techniques developed for quantum gravity,
supergravity, and especially also to supergravity theories in higher dimensions. And this is work in collaboration with Andreas Thon and Thomas Thiemann, and a summary can be found in this article here. So let me give you a brief outline of the talk. So I'm going to start with giving you a brief introduction of why we should actually consider doing quantum gravity, and then also why loop quantum supergravity. And then in part two of the talk, there will be an introduction to loop quantum gravity aimed at those people who are not familiar with the framework. So for example, people with a string theory background. And then in part three, we will go on to and discuss the original theory of loop quantum gravity in 3+1 dimensions. So here we will focus actually on the classical derivation of the theory. So we will show that there exists a certain canonical transformation in 3+1 dimensional general relativity, which allows one to write it as a Young-Mills theory. Then in the fourth part, we will actually introduce a different kind of connection formulation, which works in any dimension. So first of all, we will do this from a Hamiltonian point of view, then also a Lagrangian point of view. Then I will briefly comment on how to construct a quantum theory out of this, and also on generalizations to supergravity. And then in the fifth part, I will briefly discuss possible applications of this framework. So let's start. Why should we actually do loop quantum supergravity? So first, from the quantum gravity point of view, we have Einstein's equations, which we know describe nature very well, at least at large cosmological scales. And these equations give us a relation between the space-time metric, which encodes basically the curvature of space-time, and the energy and momentum content, which enters through the energy momentum tensor here. And now this works very good at classical scales. However, when you go to very small scales, we know that the right-hand part of this equation is quantized, so the T mu nu becomes an operator. And this is problematic because the left-hand side is not an operator, but a classical expression. So one has to try and one has to make sense out of this. And what one could do, for example, is one could try to classicalize the right-hand side somehow. So we could take some kind of expectation value here in some vacuum, for example, the Minkowski vacuum. And then we could insert this here, solve those equations, then get some metric here. And then we could iterate this process because for a different background metric, we would have a different state here. However, as was shown, this process does not converge. And especially in 2+1 dimensions, where we have a complete solution of this theory here, we see that this actually leads to some very wrong results. So we have to do something else here. Basically, the program of loop quantum gravity consists of trying to give sense to the left-hand side of this equation, but as an operator. So we're just trying to put a hat on the metric here. And then why should we actually try to extend this framework now to higher dimensions? Because it appears to work in 3+1 dimensions. And the problem is the following. When you look at the literature which is available in quantum gravity, then we find mainly two approaches. So first of all, we have a superstring theory and M theory, and then also loop quantum gravity. Now, the point is what we're doing here is we're trying to construct a theory of quantum gravity. However, we're trying to construct the theory from a purely theoretical point of view. Just because there are no experiments available. So if we want this to be successful, then this theory of quantum gravity, it should be reasonably unique. So the problem is, if we can just derive a whole bunch of theories of quantum gravity and we don't have an experiment to discriminate, then we're in big trouble because it's not clear which one to pursue. So the least thing we can do is we can try to compare results between those two theories. However, when one tries to do so, one immediately runs into problems. And those people mentioned here, it's, for example, Thiemann, who tried to perform a quantization of the string using loop quantum gravity techniques. Or these people here try to look at string actions from the loop quantum gravity point of view. However, not very many results are available now. But the immediate problem which one runs into is that superstring and M theory, they require a higher dimensions, supersymmetry, and also additional particle content. Whereas standard loop quantum gravity is formulated in 3+1 dimensions. We may couple all kinds of particles. However, there's no there's no reason why we should couple a certain kind. So we are at a, we have really a problem here. However, a way out of this might be a higher dimensional supergravity theories. And the point is that they are considered as low energy limits of the super string in M theory. And the interesting thing is they have an action principle of the type of the GR action plus more terms. And now those more terms are just matter fields and certain matter couplings. And so if we could make sense out of this part, the GR action in higher dimensions, then we could also hope that we can cover those additional matter fields and then quantize a supergravity using loop methods. So this is basically the idea here. When you, but now you can also look at this from a more abstract point of view. And this abstract point of view is the following. So when people originally tried to quantize a gravity, they ran into problems because it's non-renormalizable. So for example, if you take general relativity and go to a linear theory, you have a spin 2 particle. However, this gives you a non-renormalizable quantum theory. And then those two approaches here can be considered as ways out of this problem of non-renormalizability. For example, the string point of view, we substitute the point particle by a string. And therefore, we get rid of certain infinities. On the other hand, on the loop quantum gravity point of view, we substitute the representation we're using. So we do not use a Fock representation where we would have a graviton excitation, but we use a nonlinear Fock representation where a whole holonomy constructed from a gauge field is an excitation. And then looking at supergravities, superstring and M theory, they can be considered as quantizations of supergravity or as UV completions. But now, if we manage to construct another quantum theory of those supergravities here using the loop methods, then we might be in a better position to actually compare those two approaches to a quantizing gravity. So let's start with a brief review on loop quantum gravity. So the basic idea of loop quantum gravity is that we want to perform a canonical quantization of general relativity. So in a standard canonical quantization, there are certain steps we have to follow. So first of all, we have to perform or we have to construct a Hamiltonian formulation of our theory. And this is well known. So what you have to do is you have to split space-time into space and time. And then this will lead you to the ADM formalism. Now, this is a bit awkward at the beginning because general relativity has a space-time symmetry. However, the whole space-time diffeomorphism, they're really encoded in this Hamiltonian structure, although you're performing this split here. Then when you have your Hamiltonian formulation, you can still perform canonical transformations on your phase space because at the classical level, no variables are really preferred. So we, at the second step here, we try to find suitable variables which are easy to quantize. And this will lead us to the so-called Ashikar Barbero variables. And we will be I'll give more details later on here in the talk. Then the third part, you need to find a Hilbert space representation of your canonical variables here and their Poisson structure. And this will lead us to so-called spin networks and the Ashikar-Lewandowski measure. Then the next step, you have to find some kind of quantum equations for your, like a quantum Einstein equation or some kind of Schrödinger equation. And this, in the canonical framework, leads to you have to regularize your constraint operators. And we will see later on that one could interpret this as a kind of quantum spin dynamics. And then in the end, of course, you have to apply your framework and check for the physical consequences. And as we will see later on, this second step is only or has been only possible in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And this is why people couldn't go to higher dimensions so far. I mean, there were several attempts on solving this problem, for example, by Melos and Nicolai, where they looked at 11-dimensional supergravity and tried to fuse certain degrees of freedom there. However, this did not lead to a quantizable theory. And also Neto, he looked at a kind of Ashikar variables, but based on quaternions and octonions in 8 and 12 dimensions. However, he also didn't succeed in writing down quantum theory. Okay. So for the classical setup, as I said, we have to derive a Hamiltonian formulation for general relativity. And so the basic idea is that we take a space-time M here, and we foliate it into equal time hypersurfaces, so sigma t's here. And what you have to remember for the rest of the talk is just one thing, that whenever in the covariant theory, in the space-time theory, you had space-time indices mu nu running from 0 to 3, you have to pull back everything to your spatial slice here. And these indices will become spatial tensor indices AB running only from 1 to 3. So this is basically everything. So your canonical theory just lives on those spatial slices here. And now when you perform this pullback, you can perform a certain canonical transformation here. And we will be more, I will give more details on this transformation later on. But this will lead us to Hamiltonian general relativity, which can then be rewritten as an SO3 Young-Mills theory. And your canonical variables at this stage, they will be a gauge connection, AI here, so it has one lower tensor index, so it's a one form, and then one Lie algebra index, which makes it a connection for the case of SO3. And then conjugate to this, there's a Young-Mills momentum here, which can be considered as a Young-Mills electric field, and this will encode the metric. So we'll see later on that this is basically a three-bind or an orthonormal frame which encodes your metric. And then the non-trivial part here is that when you describe general relativity in terms of those variables here, they will have simple Poisson brackets. So A and E are conjugate to each other. This will be important later on. Now, when you have such an SO3 Young-Mills theory, you want to look for gauge invariant observables of this theory. And one starts, of course, first with the gauge degrees of freedom here. So one wants to construct SO3 invariant functions on the phase space. And when you look into the literature of gauge theory, you will find the concept of a Wilson loop, which is a good concept to construct such observables here. And so what one does in loop quantum gravity, one takes your spatial slice sigma here. So this is three-dimensional in a 3+1 dimensional theory. And then you consider a path here, a path C. And then you can, along this path, you can integrate your gauge connection here and construct the holonomy, which is just the finite parallel transport associated to this connection here. This object will then transform at the endpoints of this path. However, when you close the path and contract the indices, you will construct a Wilson loop, and this will be a gauge invariant functional then. Now, in a similar way, one can construct so-called electric fluxes. So for example, if you consider some surface here, S, you can take this conjugate momentum here, and from the tensorial structure, this has an upper index. However, we will show later on that it's densitized, so this is actually dual to a two-form, and you can integrate a two-form along a two-surface naturally. And you have to take some smearing function here, and then you can construct the electric flux. So this is basically the analogous of an electric flux in Maxwell theory. And when you now look at this picture here, you can see the following. We may draw this like this to indicate that actually this surface is cut by this holonomy here. And whenever you have such a configuration here, you can do the following. You can calculate the Poisson bracket between such an holonomy and such an electric flux. And what you will find is that the Poisson bracket will be, again, proportional to the holonomy. And this will be very important later on, and you repeat this quite some time in the talk, because this is basically the classical algebra you want to quantize. So we do not really quantize this connection here in the field, but we quantize holonomies and fluxes of this field. And at a classical level, this is basically equivalent. So it's equivalent to considering holonomies and fluxes instead of connections and momentum degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, when you proceed to the quantization of this theory, you want to be a bit more general. So you do not only want to consider Wilson loops, but we will consider what is known as a spin network here, which may be considered as a generalized Wilson loop in the following sense. So for example, again, we have our three-dimensional spatial slice sigma here. And then we could, for example, consider this loop here and calculate the Wilson loop around this loop. But this is not the most general gauge invariant function we can construct. But we can also do the following. We can consider some abstract graph gamma, which is embedded into this spatial slice here. And then we can take the edges of this graph and color them by irreducible representations of our group SO3. And then we can also take the vertices and color them by invariant maps. And now when we see what we have here, or what kinds of functions we have here, we now have those holonomies here, which run around edge CM here. They are in some representations, so they will have free indices here and here. But we will have a free index coming or incoming from every one of those edges here. But if we take an invariant map of our group and contract them here, the whole construction will be gauge invariant. So for example, for a three-valent vertex here, these invariant maps are just the well-known Clebsch-Gordan symbols for SO3. And then when you just perform all those contractions here, you will end up with a gauge invariant state. Now, so we have now our gauge invariant functions, but one has to give some sense to them or see how one can interpret them. And since we are in the theory of quantum gravity, we can, for example, construct geometric operators. So we could ask, what is the area of a surface here? So for example, this surface here. And now, in order to calculate this, we would ask first, what is the classical area of the surface? And this is just a suitable function of the metric integrated over the surface here. But now, since we have a quantization of this theory, we can just take the associated quantum operator. And as it turns out, this operator is actually diagonal on those spin network states here. And the eigenvalue of this area operator will just depend on this irreducible representation, which is associated to this edge here. You can repeat something similar with the volume operator. As it turns out, volume will be concentrated around those vertices here and depend on the invariant map, which is sitting at this intertwiner here. So then in the next step, when one considers the quantum Einstein equation, so one regularizes this Hamiltonian constraint, and one looks at what it does with such a spin network here, and what one sees is that this Hamiltonian constraint will change spins on those edges. It will change the intertwiners or invariant maps on those vertices here, but it might also change the graph here. So it might delete and add new edges. So one could use the term quantum spin dynamics to describe what the Hamiltonian constraint is doing. So from an intuitive point of view, we have some kind of quantized geometry here. However, one has to be careful here because this is just at the kinematical stage of the quantization. So we still have to implement different morphisms, and especially the Hamiltonian constraint. And something might go wrong there with this discreteness, as has been pointed out by some people in the past. So let me just briefly give you a technical point of view, because this will also be important later on. So in order to make this rigorous, what one does is, since the gauge group SO3 is compact, one can construct the so-called Ashikar-Lewandowski measure, which is basically a measure on the space of connections on such a spatial sized sigma here. And from this measure, one can construct a positive linear functional on this algebra of Hollandian fluxes here. And since one has a positive linear functional on this algebra, one can employ the CNS construction to derive a representation of this classical algebra here. And already here, we see that this quantization procedure is rather general, because whenever we have a compact group, we can construct the associated Ashikar-Lewandowski measure. And whenever we have this measure, we can construct the associated representation here. So basically, the only thing we have to do to quantize higher dimensional general relativity and also supergravity is we have to rewrite the supergravity in such a way that it has a compact gauge group. And this has basically not been possible so far. Let me briefly discuss the status of the field at the moment. So this year, we are celebrating the 25th anniversary of loop quantum gravity. And what we have so far is a rigorous canonical quantization of 3 plus 1 dimensional general relativity, and especially if you insist on the implementation of the special diffeomorphisms unitarily on the quantum level, then you can also derive that the representation you're using is unique, which is has to be seen in contrast with Haag's theorem, which tells you that in quantum theory, in general, you should expect inequivalent representations. Also, metric coupling is possible. And one can see that the quantum geometry serves as a natural regulator. So UV divergences will be absent, and also infrared divergences. We have those geometrical operators which are with a discrete spectrum, which hint at a quantized geometry at the Planck level. We can calculate the entropy of a black hole in 3 plus 1 dimensions, including logarithmic corrections, which come out in agreement with calculations from string theory and other points of view. We have loop quantum cosmology, which is basically an application of loop quantum gravity to cosmological models. And here we can resolve singularities, for example, the Big Bang singularity. And also, we have spin form models, which aim at a path integral description of the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. OK, so let's come to the more technical part of the talk. So we will be quite extensive here. So what we will do is we will rederive the 3 plus 1 dimensional formulation of loop quantum gravity here. The techniques used here, they will be very important later on for the higher dimensional case, so we will spend more time in this section. Okay, so coming back to the Hamiltonian formulation, as said earlier, what we want to do is we want to perform a space-time split of our space-time here. And so first of all, one might ask, is this even allowed? And in fact, this is allowed. So what one can show is that in order to perform this split, we have to have that M is topologically R times sigma. However, this is automatically given when our space-time is globally hyperbolic, so if there exists a well-posed initial value problem. And then again, the only thing you need to remember whenever you had space-time index mu nu running from 0 to 3, you pull it back on those equal-time hypersurfaces here, and they will become tensor indices AB running from 1 to 3. Okay. And then modulo some technicalities here, which some of you will have seen. Okay, so when you now do this, you will end up with the so-called RDM phase space due to Arnovit, Deser, and Misner in 62. And the canonical variables of this theory, they will be a spatial metric QAB here, which is just the pullback of your spatial metric of your space-time metric G mu nu to your spatial slice here. And then conjugate to this, there's a variable PAB, which is a function of Q and K, where K is the extrinsic curvature of this spatial surface here. And this just tells you how it is embedded in your space-time manifold. So you lose no information by considering those two canonical variables. And the constraints of this, and then the Hamiltonian of this theory turns out to be a totally constrained. So the Hamiltonian is a sum of two constraints here. So the Hamiltonian constraint H with some Lagrange multiplier N, and the diffeomorphism constraint HA with some multiplier NA. Now what one can check is that this object generates spatial diffeomorphism, so diffeomorphism on this spatial surface, and the Hamiltonian constraint generates a time-like diffeomorphisms. Now when you want to look at an observable of the theory, you require that it commutes with your constraints, so this just means that the observable should be gauge invariant. However, this is very problematic here because it's because already at the classical level, only the so-called ADM charts are known as solutions to those equations here. So it's very hard to find observables for general relativity. So one thing I want to point out on this slide is this plus minus sign here, which will be very important later on. And this plus minus sign here comes from, this is basically the difference if you're doing Lorentzian or Euclidean general relativity. Because the difference between Lorentzian and Euclidean general relativity is the signature of your space-time metric. However, when you pull it back to your spatial slice, you will always get a positive definite 3 metric here. So basically, you end up with the same phase space for Lorentzian and Euclidean general relativity. However, the signature of space-time is encoded in the Hamiltonian constraint now, and it's encoded in this relative sign here. So this plus minus sign is just in front of this first part here, and there's always the minus sign in front of this second part here. And in fact, later on, what we will be doing is we will be describing Lorentzian general relativity with Euclidean variables. And we will do this in order to have a compact gauge group at our disposal. So when using Lorentzian variables, you would have an SO1,3 connection. However, we want to have a compact group for the quantum theory, so we will use an SO4 connection. And this can actually be done just because the signature of space-time only appears in the constraint but does not appear in the variables. Okay. Now, when you are at this ADM phase space, again, you can perform certain canonical transformations in order to derive new variables. And so the first thing what you want to do is you want to introduce a gauge symmetry. And what you do is instead of using a metric, you will basically use a Fehlbein here or a Dreibein here, which is just an orthonormal frame here. We look at this from a bit like from a Hamiltonian point of view now, in order to get a feeling for those canonical transformations. So what one does is one performs a so-called phase-space extension. So instead of using our original variables Q and P, we will now use a densitized 3-bind EAJ here and an extrinsic curvature KAI of this index structure here. And we will first give a relation between our old and new variables. So first of all, the E is just a densitized 3-bind, and we will relate it with a spatial metric in this way. And also, this KAB will be related to our new variable KAI in this way here. So we just contract the internal index with the three bind here. But now at this point, we have too many degrees of freedom because this EAJ is just a general 3 times 3 matrix, while our QAB before was a symmetric matrix. So we have to introduce some new constraint, and this is just a standard Gauss law constraint, and you can show that this object generates SO3 gauge transformations. And it will also take out our additional degrees of freedom here. Now we have given basically the relation between those two theories, however, we still have to check if they have the same Poisson structure so that they describe actually the same dynamics. In order to do that, what we do is we postulate a new Poisson bracket between K and E. So we just say they should be canonical, conjugate to each other. And then what we have to do is we have to express Q and P in terms of E and K, and then calculate this bracket using this Poisson structure here. And what one can show is that this will give the original ADM bracket, so Q and P are conjugate while the other brackets vanish. And by showing this, we have shown that the two theories are equivalent to each other. So we now have our SO3 gauge symmetry here. However, we do not have a connection formulation yet because both K and E transform as vectors in this theory. So one somehow needs to introduce a connection here, and the straightforward way to introduce a connection is just to say, okay, we have this orthonormal frame here, this E, and so we can calculate the associated spin connection. So we just look at this equation here, where gamma is now the Christoffel symbol associated to Q. And math tells us that it has a unique solution, which is this spin connection gamma here. And what we can do now is we can take this spin connection gamma, contract it with such an epsilon symbol, and then we have a connection. However, connections are in a fine space, meaning that you can take a connection at a vector and will again have a connection. And therefore, we can add our k with some free parameter gamma. And this will give us a new connection A here. Now, this gamma is just some free parameter of the theory, and it's called the immersive parameter. So this is OK here. We can always get or use new variables like this. However, then we have to calculate the Poisson brackets of those variables. And it turns out to be easy to calculate the first bracket here because then you just have to commute E with this K here, which is 1, just because this gamma will be a function of E here only. However, the complicated bracket will be the second bracket here. A comma A has to be 0. And this is the non-trivial part which you have to show. However, it turns out that this is satisfied. So at this stage, we have now a connection formulation of a general relativity in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So let's look at this from a more more abstract point of view. So what we have here is basically a Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity on a Young-Mills phase space such that, so first of all, A and E are conjugate to each other. So just this bracket is 1, and those brackets are vanishing here. Then the Poisson algebra, the Poisson algebra has a simple form. Then A and E, they are both real valued. So at no point, we introduce the complex structure. And also, the Young-Mills gauge group is compact. SO3 is compact. So looking at this again, or looking on how this translates in the quantum theory, so the first point, we have the simple Poisson structure. This allows us, first of all, to calculate the holonomies here, which we could do, for example, for any Poisson structure. However, when calculating those brackets here, basically this relation this relation will only hold in this way for the Poisson structure we indicated. Because, for example, if you would have non-commuting A fields here, then you would also have to calculate the bracket between two holonomies here, and this would be non-zero. But in the end, what we will see is that, or what you earlier saw, that we have a kind of, our representation is such that this holonomy acts as a multiplication operator. However, when the connections would not be Poisson commuting, then we would not be able to represent this connection here as a holonomy here as a multiplication operator, and therefore we would not have access to our quantum theory. Okay. Now the compact gauge group, again, whenever you have such a compact gauge group, you can construct the so-called Ashikar-Lewandowski measure, which is a measure on the space of a distributional extension of the space of all connections here. And basically speaking, your quantum configuration space will be an L2 space over over this space here, which is just the basically the distribution extension of the space of all connections with this measure here. And then as a last step, what you have to check is that the reality conditions which you had on a classical level, they are implemented by your scalar product. And what one can check this, so you basically define your scalar product like this. You take two states, psi prime here, and integrate them against this Ashikar-Lewandowski measure, and you can check that your reality conditions are implemented by this scalar product. So for example, if you would have different reality conditions, for example, complex structures in there, then this would not be the case. And of course, this is worked by many people. Okay. So after this review of the 3 plus 1 dimension theory, let's come to the higher dimension part. So when one starts thinking about generalizing this to higher dimensions, one immediately runs into a problem. You can see this problem on this slide here. So indicated here, this only works in 3 plus 1 dimensions. The problem is the following. So what we're doing here is something funny, because what we do is we add a vector to a connection, which is something which should not work, because the connection is something which transforms in the adjoint representation of the group, while the vector transforms in the fundamental representation of the group. And in order to fix this, what we did here is we contracted this with this epsilon symbol here, which basically can be considered as an invariant map from the adjoint representation to the fundamental representation. And that this works here is basically based on the fact that the adjoint and fundamental representations of our group SO3, that they are equivalent. Now, when you scan the classical Lie groups for other groups which have this property, you will find that they don't. Or like no other group has this property, and especially for higher dimensions, we cannot use SO3, because we need a group which has at least the dimensionality of the spatial slice we are considering in order to hide our degrees of freedom in those new variables. So you are in trouble here. Okay. So. Now, the basic idea on how to generalize this to higher dimensions will be the following. So we still have to have a connection somehow. So we have to work in the adjoint representation of our group. But since we cannot use a vector to add it to our connection, the idea will be to construct some kind of adjoint of some kind of extensive curvature, which is in the adjoint representation of our gauge group. And we will do this in the following way. So instead of considering field binds which are in the fundamental representation of our gauge group, we will consider field binds which are in the adjoint representation of our gauge group. So this pi, earlier we denoted it by E, which was just the field bind. Now this pi here will be a field bind, but it will be in the adjoint representation of a group. So basically it will have one index, which is the tensor index A here, running from 1 to D, but then it will have two vector indices which are anti-symmetrized, so you have a joint index, and those group indices here, they will be for the group SOD plus 1, so they will run from 0 to D. And basically you can think of this object here like a normal field bind, however you just have to change your prescription slightly, how it relates to your spatial metric Q here, so you multiply them and just take the trace. So this is basically matrix product and then taking the trace here. And again, conjugate to this object, we want a connection, which will just be an SOD plus 1 connection. And now we have to say how it will be related to the ADM phase space, which we want to make a connection with. And the idea will again be to take some connection, which I will say something more about soon, and again add to it some function of the extrinsic curvature. And now since we have this densitized field bind in the adjoint representation, what we can actually do is we can take this object here to transform one tensor index of this extrinsic curvature into an adjoint index of our gauge group. And then we will add this with some free parameter here to this connection, and then we will have a connection here. So this will be the rough idea on how to construct those new variables. So it's rather similar to the 3 plus 1 dimension case, the only difference being that we are using those adjoint field binds here. Okay, so let's start talking about this connection here. So the construction of this connection gamma here was performed by Peter Peldan already in 93, and he called this the hybrid spin connection for the following reason. So what he was looking at, Lagrangian formulations of general relativity. So he had a formulation using field binds on the Lagrangian level. So this field bind had the symmetry group of the spacetime. So it was in three dimensions. This was an SO1,3 object. So the signatures don't match here, but this is not important for the moment. So more important is that he was considering or looking at those field binds. However, those field binds had a spatial index which was running from 1 to d because it was pulled back on the spatial slice. However, this internal index has not been pulled back to the spatial slice because it's a group index. And we saw in this Hamiltonian formulation we are performing, we are always pulling those objects back to the spatial slice. Basically, what he showed is one can consider an analogous construction to the spin connection in this way. So he wrote down an equation like this. Again, this gamma here is just the Christoffel symbol associated to the metric Q here. And then what he showed is that this equation uniquely finds the so-called hybrid connection here, which is an SO d plus 1 connection, basically. So one can solve this equation for this gamma and therefore express this gamma in terms of this E here. However, we still have to express this gamma in terms of the pi because we want to use this pi as a canonical variable. And so we have to take a next step here. And this next step is relating this pi here to this E here. And this is done by the so-called simplicity constraints, which are constraints which are already familiar from spin form models. And what one does is one takes, one uses a constraint which looks in this way. So you just take the product of two pi's here and then anti-symmetrize. Okay. The usual definition of the spin connection, the base space and the internal space have the same dimension. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the internal space is one dimension bigger than the base space. So when you count degrees of freedom in this equation, it turns out that it only has a unique solution either if those dimensions match or when the internal space is one dimension bigger than the base space. And the existence, or basically that this works here, even if the dimensionality of this internal space is one bigger, it comes basically from the fact that when you're considering a Lagrangian formulation using field binds and then pulling the space-time spin connection back to the spatial slice.
These E, how do you get them? So you started from pi, and then
yes. So from the Hamiltonian point of view, what we're doing is we postulate a new pair of canonical variables, then we relate it to the old canonical variables, which were Q and P, and then in the third step, what you have to show is that they are related, so that the Poisson structure matches.
But you need the simplicity.
You need this simplicity. Yes, you need the simplicity. So those relations can only be satisfied on the simplicity constraint surface.
So you cannot construct this connection gamma as a function of pi.
I mean, you can.
Only as a function of the solution.
You can construct it as a function of pi. So what you do is you construct it first as a function of E, and then what you know is that on the constraint surface, pi is given by this function here. But then you can take certain contractions on or polynomials in pi to extract both n and e here from this object, and then you can insert this into here.
Yeah, so but only if the simplicity constraint is satisfied.
Yes, only when the simplicity constraint is satisfied, this gamma hybrid of pi will be equal to the gamma hybrid of e. However, at the level when you are calculating those brackets, you are not using that.
I'm confused about how you define gamma of pi. So you have gamma of E, and then now you get gamma of pi.
Okay.
Outside the simplicity constraint.
Yes. So you have a gamma of E, and then, for example, we can ask how do we get EAI, and one way to get it would be, for example, take some, or let's make it easier to construct this object here. So that you could then get this by just taking pi aij times. NJ.
Yeah, but where is the n?
Yeah, then you need an n. But you can construct an n here, at least in odd dimensions. So basically, since n, this n will be orthogonal on those e's, you can construct it like, for example, like this, ij, k, l, ej, k, el, modulo density.
Yeah, but you don't have e.
Yes, okay, now let's go one dimension smaller. Then you can write this object as pi a j m pi b k m. And on the constraint surface, this will be basically on the constraint surface, this is n times e. So you get basically two, since n is orthogonal to e, when you multiply this out, you basically get n here, or you get the n outside. However, j and k are intersymmetric, so the n cannot be on jk, so it has to be inside here. So now, but now this object here just depends on pi, and you can put it here now.
So when does it work on the dimension 3? Or
this construction would work in odd dimensions because you could this is just to indicate how you can do it. So this would, you can take the single I and I in odd dimensions. You can also construct the following object, n I and j. You can construct this in any dimension. This is something like pi a I k pi a j k minus some number times eta I j, which is the metric, the Minkowski metric, or so this will be on the simplicity constraint, surface gives you this. But it turns out that in this canonical transformation, you always have the case that you actually need two n's. So it's sufficient to express this like this. But you can also write down an expression for n in even dimensions, only using pi's, but then you would have to involve like a square root. But it's possible. And in the calculations you will do in the end, you will always express this n and this pi in terms of solely in terms of pi. So basically, you can write now e and n in terms of this pi here, and you would insert this into this gamma of e.
I'm a bit confused because pi has more components than just n and
e. Yes, it does.
E.
But
so,
the additional components are removed because we have an additional constraint here.
Yeah, but that's what I'm asking. So if I have the constraints, it's fine, but can you do this outside the simplicity constraint? This is the thing I don't understand. Outside the simplicity constraint, there's more to pi than just e and n.
So basically, what you can show is that the Prossmann bracket QAB PCB in terms of pi and a expressed in this above way, this is, yeah.
I guess I don't understand, what do you define by gamma of
here.
Pi? How do you define gamma of pi?
Okay, so gamma of e can be defined by this equation here, okay?
Yes.
And then I have defined e in terms of gamma in this way. So for every e which I have here, so for every e ai which I have here, I can express a component in this expression. And then I have a definition for gamma of pi.
So isn't it ambiguous? Because you have many pi's that cross.
It is ambiguous, but at the classical level, it doesn't matter. Basically, it will not be ambiguous. I mean, it is ambiguous, and the ambiguity comes from the simplicity constraint. However, this is not a problem because what you basically do in order to reobtain the KAB, you will calculate something like AA IJ minus gamma A IJ hybrid times pi B IJ, so this would be roughly the case. However, this object is invariant under the simplicity constraint because when you commute a times pi with the simplicity constraint, this will give you again a simplicity constraint because just one pi is substituted by this other pi here. So this k is a weak observable with respect to the simplicity constraint. And so this gives you the freedom to choose an expression for gamma of pi which suits you best for the calculations.
Basically, that a commute outside the simplicity constraint, for instance? with A, does it commute outside of the?
No, I mean it, so.
So then you cannot use the loop for commutation.
No, no. You have. This holds.
So only when the simplicity constraint is satisfied.
Yes, but
so
you see,
you're going to work outside.
The point is that. I mean, this works classically, but what you're doing is you quantize the simplicity constraint in the end. So you perform a Dirac quantization at the level where the simplicity constraint is not solved, and therefore you can use this representation.
Mm-hmm. So it works, okay. It works essentially once you solve the simplicity constraint, then it works, because the A commutes.
No, the point is once you solve the simplicity constraint, you're back in ADM, or once you calculate something like a Dirac bracket.
Yeah, that's my issue there.
So the point is what, for example, the work of Aleksandrov before, when they used the Dirac bracket in order to get around this problem, is when you use the Dirac bracket, the A will not be self-commuting anymore. And so from what we know is the only point when A is self-commuting is when you're working at this level where, at the classical level where the simplicity constraint is still a first-class constraint. And then you have to Dirac quantize this simplicity constraint and treat it at the quantum level.
Okay, but we agree that outside, just to be clear, outside the simplicity constraints, the A do not commute, even in your context.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so, okay, now what we have done is we have expressed this gamma here now as a function of pi, and now we are in place to basically extract, for example, this K out of this connection here in the way which I've written down back here. So what we have to check now is that this is a valid phase-space extension for general relativity. So what we do is we express Q in terms of pi and A, we express P in terms of pi and A, then we postulate a new bracket, which is just a simple bracket telling us that A is conjugate to pi, and then we calculate those brackets, and it turns out that basically you get the ADM brackets. And then something I want to stress here is that what we have done here is we have used SOD plus 1 as an internal gauge group. However, this whole construction also works for SO 1, D. And this independence of the internal signature also works for the Green case. And again, why this works is that from both Euclidean and Lorentzian general relativity, you obtain the same ADM phase space. However, only the constraints differ in this relative sign. But what one now has to do is that, in order to get the theory in terms of SOD plus 1 or SO 1, D, is one has to basically take the Q and P and express it in terms of pi and A. And it will turn out that it's not the same when using SO 1, D and SOD plus 1 as one would expect, but the Hamiltonian constraint will look different when using SOD plus 1 or SO 1, D. One can now also look at this from a Lagrangian point of view, and the starting point here would be a canonical analysis of the Plebansky action. So one does something very similar to spin form models, which is just taking BF theory plus simplicity constraint and perform a canonical quantization or performing a canonical analysis of this. So when one does this, one runs into problems because one will find a second class partner for the simplicity constraint, and therefore you would have to deal with second class constraints on the quantum level. And ways around this would, for example, be to solve the second class constraints on the classical level. However, this will lead you to the ADM formalism, which we do not know how to quantize because it's just the object which we started with. On the other hand, one could calculate the Dirac bracket between the second class constraints. However, then the A would not be a self-commuting, and you could not use your representation here. So this is a bit problematic here because it seems to contradict the previous slide. However, you can basically make this work in the following way. You can employ a construction which is called gauge unfixing, which is basically the opposite of gauge fixing. So basically, gauge fixing can be considered in the following way. You have first class theory, and then you impose a second class constraint as a gauge fix, or as a new constraint as a gauge fixing to this first class constraint. But this also works in the other way around. So you can take a theory with
second class constraints and basically get rid of half of the constraints and then have a theory with the first class constraints. So it's not really that easy, but there's a well-defined procedure of how to do this, and this was developed by those people here. And this will, and when you basically apply this to the theory you found here, then you see that this second class constraint, which is second class with the simplicity constraint, can be removed, and this gives you the same result as the Hamiltonian derivation. So there are two restrictions when you use this Lagrangian derivation, which is that internal and external signatures have to match because you start from a space-time covariant theory, and there's no free parameter appearing. So let's see how this now translates to the quantum theory. So in our construction, both a and pi, they're real variables, so no complex structure has been used at any point. The Poisson algebra has a simple form that pi and, a and pi are conjugate, and our gauge group is compact, so we have access to the loop quantization methods. And you can treat now the constraints basically the same as in loop quantum gravity. You can consider gauge invariant spin networks. You get the Gauss constraints solved. Then spatial diffeomorphisms can be treated as in loop quantum gravity. The Hamiltonian constraint can be regularized in the same way as in loop quantum gravity. Then we still have to deal with the simplicity constraint, but there exists several proposals in the literature on how to deal with this, basically because this was already known in spin form models. So basically, the constraint operators can be defined, and we therefore have a quantum theory for higher dimensional general relativity. So what's happening when we also use supergravity? Now, yes, you want to impose them at the quantum level only.
Yeah, you want to impose them. But then at this level, the A do not commute if you don't impose the simplicity constraint. That's what you just told me. So you cannot really use the loop representation.
But, I mean, it would be the same for the Gauss constraint. So, for example, these brackets also only hold up to the Gauss constraint, and you solve the Gauss constraint at the quantum level.
Yeah, but the A, I'm not talking about this bracket, I'm talking about the A with the A. You told me that they do not commute.
I mean, you postulate this bracket, so you postulate that the A commutes with the pi, so especially that A comma A is zero, and then you can show that the AM brackets are reproduced, but only on the simplicity constraint surface. But this is already the same for the plus one dimensional case, where the ADM brackets are only reproduced up to Gauss constraints.
So this was not the question. The question is whether A with
okay,
A with A is...
Okay, then I misunderstood you. Then A commutes with itself. Yes, it does.
Outside the constraint surface.
Yes. Now, when you look at supergravity theories, you see that there are two new things. So first, the first thing is new matter fields. So you get additional scalars, fermions, gauge fields. You get Rieter-Schwinger fields, which are basically spin 3-half fields. And then you get additional p-forms. And you also get a new symmetry, which mixes bosons and fermions, which is just a supersymmetry. So the question is, does a Hamiltonian formulation exist? And yes, you can also form a Hamiltonian formulation of this. So this new symmetry will give you the so-called supersymmetry constraint, which is just a new constraint to your algebra of constraints. And then the matter fields, they have to be incorporated in our scheme, and especially they have to be incorporated in this SOD plus one scheme. This would be the next slide. But then basically, what you do is, again, you decompose your supergravity action in the space-time split. So you always have this gravity part here, which is just the symplectic potential for gravity and the Hamiltonian diffeomorphism Gauss constraint. Then in every supergravity theory, you have the Rieter-Schwinger field with this symplectic potential, and you always get the supersymmetry constraint with a multiplier here. And then depending on which dimension and which supergravity you are, you get additional tensor fields, vectors, spin 1/2, and scalars, but also additional tensor constraints, with the gauge constraints for those p-forms here. So what one has to do is one has to deal with these objects. Basically, work on supergravity in the loop context basically beforehand was mainly centered around complex Ashtekar variables and supergroups. So in the beginning, people developed a canonical transformation for n equals to 1 supergravity in 4 dimensions with complex variables. Then people try to use supergroups in order to describe this framework. However, the supergroup was also based on the complex variables. Then later on, Ligon Smolin elaborated on this supergroup construction. Also, an attempt to quantize topological M theory was made. And here Sawaguchi worked on the classical formulation of supergravity in terms of real variables. Okay. So then again, back to supergravity, does it really generalize? Yes, it does. So we can treat all those matter fields up here. So we can treat fermions, Dirac, Weyl, Majorana fermions. We can treat gauge fields as long as they have a compact gauge group, which is, however, satisfied, for example, by the standard model and by most supergravities. We can treat scalar fields. We can treat the Reiter-Schwinger fields and also abelian p-forms. So one word here, one word of caution here. So this is basically the most difficult part, because the Reiter-Schwinger fields, as also the Majorana fermions, yes?
On the previous slide, you wrote root g in the symplectic potential for the gravitinos.
Yes.
Do you keep that later?
No.
Okay, because I was wondering about that.
I mean, it's a standard trick in supergravity to absorb the force root of q into each of the spinors here.
Yes, because that's what I was wondering about.
You will do that, yes.
Okay, good.
But the main problem with those spinors here is that they are Majorana, and therefore they obey a Majorana condition. However, the existence or the Majorana condition is tied to space, to the space-time signature, and also the dimension you're working in. And whenever you have a Majorana condition for a Lorentzian signature, you do not have this Majorana condition for the Euclidean signature. So it's very problematic here to use those, to extend this Majorana condition also to when you're using SOD plus 1 as an internal group. However, this can be done basically by fusing certain gravitational and degrees of freedom with this Reiter-Schwinger field. And here we, at the moment, we have a restriction that we can only work in dimensions where we have, where Majorana representation of the Dirac matrices exists. So this would, for example, exclude 5, 6, and 7 dimensions. However, the interesting cases, for example, 10 and 11 dimensions are included. So what is not treatable so far, non-abelian p-form fields, because when you have a non-abelian p-form field, you would have to prescribe on how to integrate your group indices basically over two or three surfaces or higher dimensional surfaces. And this is basically what higher gauge theory tries to deal with, and we have not looked into this so far. And also non-compact gauge groups are not treatable so far because we do not know how to construct this Ashikar-Lewandowski measure for them. So what can we do now with this? So just to give three examples, so I claim that canonical quantizable supergravities include the following. So d equals to 4, n equals to 8 supergravity, which is interesting because it might be perturbatively quantizable. But also we can do d equals to 10, n equals to 1, the supergravity, which is expected to be the low energy limit of string theory, or one string theory, and then also the 11 dimensional supergravity, which is expected to be related to M theory. And again, to be precise here, what I mean with canonically quantizable is the following. There exists a representation of a Poisson subalgebra, which splits points in phase space, so it's big enough, on a Hilbert space H, whose scalar product implements the classical reality conditions and supports the representation of the constraint operators. So what I'm not claiming here is that, for example, the constraint algebra is somehow implemented off-shell. This is something one would really like to have, and we do further work in the future, especially for the brackets including the supersymmetry constraint. However, we haven't looked into this. So this might, for example, be a good place in order to get rid of certain ambiguities in the construction of those constraint operators.
Sorry, so does that mean there are some supergravities that are not quantizable, modulo p-form?
Yes, for example, yeah.
I suggest there might be some for this. For
so
this.
Basically, the first problem is at the moment we have to have a Majorana representation of the gamma matrices, so it does not work in 5, 6, 7, modulo 8. Then there are some supergravities with non-compact p-forms, which arise.
P-form thing.
Yeah, okay. And then I'm not aware that there are non-compact gauge. There are also non-compact gauge groups which arise in compactifications. Some.
So are these the only ones left?
No, these just include. So basically, you can most likely also do the other ones in 10 dimensions. So I was told So the problem here is that, for example, I'm not aware of a Hamiltonian formulation of type 2b supergravity. I mean, string theorists told me that it exists, but I haven't checked myself, so I didn't include it here. So, but then if it exists, then you can also put type 2b here, for example, or type 2a. And there's also like the heterotic one, which is like 10-dimensional coupled to super young Mills, which also has a Hamiltonian formulation, which I'm aware of. So there are more. And also like 8 and 9 dimensions work. Okay, so let me briefly discuss certain possible applications of those of these variables now. So basically the long-term goals of this research project, or where we have started it, is first of all to establish connection to superstring theory and maybe also the gauge gravity world. Then we want to compare the string and loop quantizations set in the beginning. Then it would be very interesting to see if an anomaly-free representation of the super Dirac algebra can be found. As an application for something into or inside quantum gravity, it would be interesting to study or to see to what extent we can use supersymmetry to study solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint operator, because now by constructing solutions to the supersymmetry constraint operator, you will automatically construct solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint operator as long as you have non-anomalous algebra. This will maybe teach us something about also the Hamiltonian constraint, including matter fields and fermions. And from the cosmological point of view, it would be interesting to see if we can get some signatures of supersymmetry or higher dimensions in cosmological observables. Say a bit more about this next slide. So, some more immediate applications are the calculation of black hole entropy. So the calculation of black hole entropy is possible in different theories. So for example, the original calculations by Wegenstein and Hawking, but also string theory calculations and gravity calculations. And so we are working on this right now, and it seems that we can also repeat this basically for higher dimensions. So it would be very interesting to now see if we can get the same numbers in also in higher dimensions. Because here also we have different topologies of black holes, for example, the black rings in 5 dimensions. And then you will also do, or you can also do something like loop quantum cosmology in higher dimensions. Again, here we have calculations from string cosmology and also from string cosmology, which we can now compare our results with. But I think here it's also very interesting to work on loop quantum cosmology in higher dimensions and supersymmetry. Also without looking at string theory, because what people are doing at the moment is they are trying to get some predictions from loop quantum cosmology for some cosmological observables, for example, the cosmic microwave background. And the quantum effects which arise there are really high energy quantum effects from very close after the Big Bang. And this is a good place, I think, to start looking for deviations of the standard results in 3+1 dimensions, which come from higher dimensions or supersymmetry, because the energy at which those processes take place are basically the highest energies which we might have access to. So it would be very interesting to check for traces in cosmological observables. Then, as the last slide, my most tentative slide, so it would be very interesting to have some connection with the ADS CFT correspondence. So, and I do not claim to be any kind of expert on this or know much more than is written on the slide. However, what I do know is that there's a conjectured exact equivalence between gauge and gravity theories. So as one example, one could have type 2B string theory on ADS 5 times S5 and n equals to 4 super young Mills in 4 dimensions, where this 4 dimensions is the boundary of this ADS 5 here. And then both theories are governed by 2 coupling constants, so the string coupling and string tension on this side, and Young-Mills coupling and number of colors on this side, and then they are related by those equations here. However, it's very hard to check this correspondence at this top level because it's very hard to perform generic calculations in those two theories. So what one does in general is one goes to a low energy limit to test this equivalence. So one takes weak string coupling, strong string tension, then only massless states survive, and you will end up with type 2B supergravity multiplet. And on this side, you take weak Young-Mills coupling and strong TOF coupling, then only planar diagrams survive, and also the calculations in super Young-Mills become tractable. And you will get this theory at strong TOF coupling, and then this equivalence is basically well tested at this level. However, for tests and also for applications, one wants to go basically beyond perturbation theory and type 2B supergravity. And here, what I hope to do in the future would be to look at, into this problem, basically try to find some new non-perturbative limit of this this exact equivalence here by looking at some kind of a loop quantized type 2B supergravity and then relate it to some kind of or some sector of this supergravity theory. However, there are a lot of question marks here because I'm not really, most parts here aren't really sure. For example, what does it mean to have loop quantum gravity on ADS5 times S5? So there was some work of Laurent here in terms of 2 plus 1 dimensions. However, here, since we now have access to those loop quantized supergravities, it might be interesting also to look at higher dimensions. Okay, so let me briefly conclude the talk. So I've shown that D plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian general relativity can be formulated as an SO D plus 1 Young-Wills theory. Loop quantum gravity methods apply, so a rigorous quantization exists. Extensions to interesting supergravities also exist, and I've listed some possible applications. So thank you for your attention.
A few minutes for questions.
Yeah. How far have we got? So I have a two-part question, but let me start the other way. If you think about comparing black hole entropy calculations between string theory and loop quantum gravity, an essential role is played in the string theory calculations by the extended supersymmetry algebra. Basically, you want to find representations of it in flat space time or one to compute the entropy explicitly. In the case where you wanted to study a theory with an extended supersymmetry algebra and loop quantize it, what would be the space of connections? Would you be using superconnections, and would they be superconnections valued in the supersymmetry extension of SOD plus one?
It might be yes. However, we have not looked at the superconnection formulation of those theories yet. So right now we are basically still working only in higher dimensions when looking at black holes. So it's not really clear what will be happening on the black hole horizon. For example, in loop quantum gravity, for example, you do not have to take the Hamiltonian constraint into account on the horizon, because you can show that by appropriate boundary conditions, basically the multiplier goes to zero there. So something similar might happen to the supersymmetry constraint, just because the supersymmetry constraint is the square root of the Hamiltonian constraint. So you would expect that something similar happens on the horizon, but we haven't checked this yet. So it's, to me, it's unclear what's really happening on the horizon in case of supersymmetric loop quantum gravity.
Is there an analog of deep brains in the higher dimensional supersymmetry?
We haven't looked into this.
Do you have a plan? I mean, the string theory results, again, are very striking. And if one wants to duplicate them, I mean, there's two ways. One can just get lucky, or one can try sort of step by step to reproduce what was done there. I don't know. Do you have a plan? Or?
I mean, the plan will... The plan will just be to, first of all, try to repeat what has been done in loop quantum gravity to get a better feeling for those variables. And then when looking at string theory, there are, of course, brains. For example, you could add the brain action to your supergravity action, then try to somehow loop quantize the brain action. But we haven't looked into this, so I can't say anything.
So the calculation in string theory are mostly about extreme black holes.
Yes. So right. You would also have to consider extreme black holes.
But
here.
How do you do that? Because we don't even know how to do that in usual MQG, to impose the extremality condition.
So I also don't know.
Well, if you don't have more questions, Norbert will be here until Friday. So let's thank him again.